From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio, focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob.
That's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made. Appreciate you all being with us on the Bishop's Radio Hour as we launch our 23rd year on the air. Appreciate all of you who have supported us along the way, and especially you, the listeners. It continues to be a labor of love and a complete joy. Well, we are pleased to welcome in one of our great seminarians here in the Diocese of Sacramento, Matt Grimm. Matt, good day to you.
Good evening, Bob. Very good to be on with you.
Yeah, good to hear your voice, Matt. We just came off a wonderful vocations dinner at Good Shepherd Parish in Elk Grove. And the wonderful part about it, in addition to meeting a lot of the seminarians, was that it was sold out. People were there to support our seminarians.
Yes, it was very well attended. We had not only the seminarians, we also had several of the Pro Ecclesia Santa sisters, several from vocations throughout the diocese, as well as the Knights of Columbus hosting it, as they generously have done each year.
Plus, a lot of our altar servers were honored.
Yeah,
it's a wonderful evening. If people have never attended that, mark your calendars for next year, because it's a very inspiring evening. Well, Matt, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am currently about to begin my first year of seminary. I'm 23 years old, and I'm from the town of Rockland, California. Mm-hmm. For anyone who doesn't know, that's just east of Sacramento within the diocese. And I grew up at St. Rose of Lima School in Roseville.
Mm-hmm.
I have one younger sister, a few years younger than me, currently in her second year of college. And I ended up going to Jesuit High School, and afterwards did a few years at UC Berkeley studying engineering before I got to where I am today with the diocese.
Wow. Engineering at UC Berkeley to the seminary. That's quite a transition.
Yes. So my parents actually are both civil engineers, mostly transportation wise. And as I was growing up, I got to see how they were able to use that discipline as a way to serve other people in terms of their practical needs, whether that was building roads and bridges or just the infrastructure people need. And I was always more geared towards math and science, so I figured I'll study that in college. And the service aspect of that was something very strong for me, and also ended up, I would say, as a key factor in my own discernment of my vocation throughout the past several years.
So you go down to Cal, and you were there how long? 2 years?
I was actually there for 5 years.
So did you get your degree?
I did. I ended up doing a 1 year master's program following. I got my bachelor's in 2021, and then they offered a really good deal for me to get a master's degree. And at that time, I was actively preparing to transition, from discernment to being a candidate with the diocese actively applying, and it looked like a program that would be well suited for me. It was a good opportunity, so that's what I was doing.
Wow. So, at what point in this process did the Lord tap you on the shoulder?
Yeah, I would say it really started in the later years of high school. Of course, the Jesuit spirituality of the Ignatian tradition was something that first started kicking off in my heart, a desire to give my life to Christ in a significant and a meaningful way. And an important part of that was the Kairos retreat they had. If any of the listeners are familiar with that, it's a 4-day retreat put on. Anyone who's gone to Jesuit would know about this. But for me, I ended up going on two retreats. The first one was in, 2016 now, and I kind of entered in with shallower intentions, I would say, really just trying to see what I could get out of it, how I could feel good about myself and my faith life, or say, you know, I'm doing enough for where I am. I'm a cradle Catholic, and I have gone to church on Sundays, but at that point it was mostly doing pretty much what I had to do, but not much more. But after that first retreat, I actually came out of it feeling a little bit dissatisfied just with myself and in my own approach to it. And at the prompting of some of my campus ministers, I applied to lead the same retreat the following year. And that second time, I was much more focused on what can I give to my Jesuit brothers, how can I be present to them in this retreat and allow them to just hear whatever God is trying to tell them at this point in their lives. And I discovered afterwards that when I focused on them instead of myself, I found that peace and that greater sense of fulfillment that I believe God wanted to give me the first time. And that kind of kicked off in my heart the questioning of, well, this was something I wasn't expecting. It was a little outside my comfort zone. Is there something else that God might be asking of me that I haven't considered to this point?
Mm-hmm.
And the topic of vocation first started to come up at that point.
Wow. Had you considered that, you know, growing up or a Jesuit or your undergraduate years at Cal?
You know, it hadn't really popped up too much before, I'd say before that point, mid to late high school. There a couple times in grade school where I'd known about, you know, priesthood, and I just, you know, kind of the sense of, oh, man, that could be something like being a firefighter or being a police officer one day where I could do. But I never really gave it much more thought. When I was in college, in particular the middle few years of my time in college, it was a time where I was able to not only grow in my own prayer life and my own individual relationship with God, but also serve on the student ministry team that they had at the Newman Center down in Berkeley.
Yeah.
And that experience was something that very much opened me up to the joys and also the challenges, as you know, of being involved in a parish community. And I should also note, this is in the Diocese of Oakland, so it was a little bit different that the Newman Center was a full-time parish, which is different than what we have in Sacramento.
Right. Yeah, there is a rumor that the Newman Center in Berkeley would hold Mass on Sunday night at 10 o'clock. Is that true?
That is true. I believe they've moved it back to 9 p.m.
Okay.
Nowadays, but they called it the last chance Mass.
That's morning for some college students.
For some students, yes.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, oh, that's great. You know, whatever works.
Yeah, I mean, if there are students coming to Mass, I think that and the 5 p.m. evening Mass were the two most common ones. So.
Right.
Whatever works.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So if you hadn't felt the call for a vocation, what do you think you'd be doing now with your master's degree?
I think I would have applied to some type of engineering job, particularly if my focus so far in my education has been on environmental engineering, water resources in particular, and I see a lot of good, especially in California, that can be done to provide people with clean drinking water.
Mm-hmm.
That's something, again, the service aspect of that was something that was a big part of my discernment of desiring to serve the people of God in a unique way, and not just through the more physical necessities that people need, also through the spiritual necessities, through the sacraments, in particular the Eucharist, through reconciliation. Those were things that were very strong for me as I was considering my vocation.
So what did your parents say when you came home and said, I'm thinking about becoming a priest?
Yeah, my parents are both Catholic, and have been really supportive of me and my younger sister. And I think there was a little bit of confusion at first, just in the sense of, well, is there reason that you want to do this as opposed to you're going to a good school, you're getting a good degree, you know, and you can still live a good Catholic life and
sure.
do engineering work.
Right.
But they have been really supportive of me throughout this whole process, providing me the resources I need and making sure I know that they will support me whichever path God chooses for me, which I know that, you know, that's a blessing. I would say that nowadays it's probably pretty hard to find that.
I think you're right. Although you know, parents ultimately, most of them, want what's best for their kids.
Yeah.
And if you... you know, if they know you're of sound mind and body, they will certainly maybe they're stunned, maybe they're shocked, maybe they're surprised, but they will certainly support you if they think you've got good reasons. I feel that way about my kids, who are certainly not clones of me, you know, and
yeah, sure.
have chosen yeah. their own path, and as long as I think it's a healthy path, I mean, where I don't feel like, hey, I really need to step in and say something here, you know, I try to encourage them.
No, most definitely.
Wow, that is quite a transition. But you know, I've over the years that I've talked to seminarians, I'm always fascinated with how different everyone's story is.
And that's part of the beauty of it. The church is one, but it's unity and diversity, and just being able to see people from all different walks of life, not only among seminarians that I've got to meet, but also among all the faithful, is a testament to the universality of the church.
Yeah, the universality of the church is something my dad taught me very young, and we'd go on vacation long before the internet existed, and you could, you know, Google where's the nearest Catholic church and what's the mass time, and we could be on vacation in some little town in Idaho, and Dad always knew where the church was, and he would always get us there, and he would tell us, this is going to be mass just like the mass you go to at home, you know, it's going to be the same, this church, it's going to be the same all over the world. And it was that really, really stuck with me, you know, that there must be something to this, you know, that these people in a town that we have very little in common with are participating in the same mass that we participate at home in Davis. You know, it was profound.
It is, yeah. Thank you, Bob. That's beautiful.
So you decide to go to seminary, you can't do it alone. You gotta yes. convince somebody else that besides your parents that this is what you want to do. So, what's your next step?
What did you do next?
You don't have to be a diocesan priest, and it doesn't have to be in the Diocese of Sacramento.
Yes. So, as I was going to my first year of college, I had never had a spiritual director before. That was when I first started to look into that.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to a religious group called the Oblates of St. Joseph.
Oh, sure.
I'm sure
many right.
of our, especially, you know, St. Joseph's Workshop and Father Matthew, and I'm sure many of our listeners here will be familiar with him. But I went to Father Sergio Perez with the Oblates, mm-hmm. and spent a couple of years not really thinking in terms of religious versus diocesan priesthood, more just thinking about, is God telling me to be a priest? And then mm-hmm. and then after I look a little bit into that, I can delve into some of the details there. And I believe it was April 2019, when I had went on a retreat with them back at their monastery up in Loomis near where I'm at.
Right, right.
And I got to experience the beauty of their shared community life, the adoration. Of course, they were devoted to St. Joseph, so we had plenty of working time and plenty of discussions, shared meals. And after that retreat, I was really grateful for the opportunity. And one of the fruits of it was also a recognition that of the differences in the community life that a religious priest would have versus the diocesan priest who is really centered on his parish that he's mm-hmm. at. And that difference was something that I hadn't really considered very much before, but that I began to realize there was a tug on my heart towards the community, the people of God, towards the parish community as something that God might be calling me towards. So around that point, 3 years ago, was when I got in contact with our vocation director for the diocese, Father Memo, and continued my discernment with him. That's where I was the past few years before applying and being accepted.
What were the most difficult questions they asked you? Obviously, they want you to discern. They don't want someone who's not going to turn out to be a good candidate or a good priest, not for any moral, that too, but not for any moral defect, but just might not be your cup of tea.
Yeah, I think one of the trickiest things so far that I've experienced relates to, we have what's called the four pillars of formation mm-hmm. in seminary, but then even outside of that, it's about holistic formation of the human person. So there's human formation, intellectual formation, spiritual, and then apostolic or pastoral, as I was taught. And for me, I'm more of an introverted person. So I think in particular, the human formation, the aspect of learning to build my collaborative skills with others, of being able to communicate well and be courageous in many situations when I needed to be, that has been a big skill that I have been and continue to be working on, especially as, you know, God willing, a parish priest, a priest of the diocese one day. That's a really important aspect of ministry. So I think questions related to how am I going to grow in this area, how am I going to rely on God to give me that grace to build up those areas that I'm weaker in right now.
So because you have a college degree, your seminary path is different than some of other people that wouldn't have a degree.
Correct. So for me, I believe it will be 8 years. From where I stand, previously it would have been 7, which includes 2 years of philosophy studies, mm-hmm. 4 years of theology, and a pastoral year. And then I believe Ralph Conchi, the other incoming seminarian, has been on your program before.
Right.
And he probably also brought up the propedeutic program, the new program,
right.
Encouraged all the way up by the Vatican, basically as an initial formation year to immerse incoming seminarians into the lifestyle of the seminary. It includes intellectual studies, but it's not explicitly focused so much strongly on that as on developing the prayer lifestyle, of being able to function in the seminary community, of forming those relationships with your formators, those types of aspects. So that propedeutic program will be my first of 8 years.
Mm-hmm. And that'll be at Mount Angel up in Oregon?
Mine will actually be at St. Patrick's in Menlo Park.
Okay.
I believe Mount Angel is starting its propedeutic program this year, and there might be slight differences between the program for men coming in with college degrees versus without.
Mm-hmm.
But I will be starting at St. Patrick's this August.
Okay. And will you be at St. Pat's for all 8 years? Or most of them?
That is a great question. I do not know for certain yet, but I believe a big part of it is based on my conversations with my formators, discussing based on the academic program, and then of course just outside factors, the people around me, or be it what may.
So,
but it is, as far as I know, it's possible that I'll be at St. Patrick's for most, if not all, of my formation.
Mm-hmm.
But I do not know for certain, so I don't want to tell you something that I might later regret saying.
So you see yourself as a parish priest?
I do. It's one of those things that's hazy, I would call it. I know that there's a lot in me that needs to, there's a lot of formation, there's a lot of growth that I need to experience and work on first. For example, with those people skills, essentially, that I had brought up earlier. But I do, and I see more and more as I've progressed in my discernment and up until now, it's been a source of joy for me and something where I imagine myself being involved in ministry years down the line and profoundly happy and fulfilled doing that as a form of service to the people of God, and it's something that I believe is a gift from God to me as well, as something that he has called me to.
So is studying theology and philosophy, is that something that's intriguing? Is it something that's daunting?
A little bit of both. It is the highest science, isn't it?
Yeah.
I've been fortunate in that I've had several very intelligent friends at the Newman Center, some of them who I've lived with, who have been really involved in things like Aquinas 101, who have been involved with education and faith development, children's catechesis, other programs that are really focused on teaching the aspects of our faith at whatever educational level. So I've been exposed to it before, and although I know that it's going to be very different and working a very different side of my, not only my brain, but also my heart and soul, as opposed to something like engineering, it's something that I do greatly look forward to. And believe that, especially with this propedeutic program, this will be a really good opportunity for me to gradually ease my way into those studies.
So, what will happen in this first year? What is that about, and why is it being instituted?
So, as I understand, the main reason it's being instituted is to provide a more thorough preparation for men considering priesthood as kind of a transition stage where we talk about discernment all the time, and oftentimes, as it has been for me so far, we do that in the midst of a very hectic world, whether we're studying, working, switching between jobs or locations, and there's a lot of noise out there. So the propedeutic program is really designed to take away some of that noise, allow a man to step back for a period of time, to be in, of course, communication with not just one spiritual director, but many formators who will be able to guide him in all those different pillars of formation, and really make, I would say, an advanced discernment, almost an advanced discernment, to make sure that he is well-suited and prepared for the life that seminary and ultimately priesthood is going to entail.
So almost maybe the Pope is thinking, let's hit this discernment hard early.
I would say so. It's something that this program is something that from many of the priests and the older seminarians who I've met have said they would love to have a program like this to build themselves in their own spirituality and their own formation. And it's not something that's applied retroactively, of course, but
right.
But it has pointed me towards just this seems like a really good thing that's being instituted.
So is there coursework involved?
There is some coursework. It's not going to be as intense as the years of formal philosophy and theology studies, but there is coursework involved. As I understand it, some of the other aspects are going to be you're with other propedeutic men from not just Sacramento but other dioceses, from I believe Spokane, Washington, from Santa Rosa, from Stockton, from all sorts of different areas, and you're really going to be spending a lot of time with that community, forming tight relationships with those future seminarians for most of them, as well as having the shared prayer life, the shared communal life. And I believe there's also going to be opportunity for visiting, for instance, nearby parishes to, mm-hmm. to the seminary to really meet the people of God and practice what we're, God willing, going to be doing for the rest of our lives once we're ordained.
So what do you look forward to the most?
I think in the immediate, more proximate side of my mind, well, I'm really looking forward to this corporal duty here. And I say that in particular, Bob, because when I first learned about it, I was still excited about it, but part of it in my mind also told me, okay, it will be another year of formation and before being ordained. But the part of me that was really focused on bringing the sacraments to the people of God, to the spiritual role of the priest in providing for his people, I see in this program a powerful opportunity through the prayer and through the sacrifices and through the growth that will take place in that time. I see that as something I can offer to God on behalf of all the people of the Diocese of Sacramento, but in particular for the people who I'm going to be serving and who I'm going to be ministering to in future years, as a kind of offering to God. I'm really excited to be able to do that, and I think that will bear at least as much fruit as you know, many years of shall I say, more outward or more hands-on ministry, so to speak.
Is 8 years, is that daunting, or is it just, no, this is going to be fun, this is going to be interesting, this is going to be exciting?
Most of me, I would say that it's an exciting prospect.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, there's a little bit of, okay, that is a long time, it's a commitment, but part of that is to point me, and I believe rightly so, to the fact that priesthood, like any vocation, is a lifelong commitment, and I want to be able to take that seriously, and so part of that is going to be taking the necessary time to grow in those different pillars of formation.
So it's not like somebody's telling you you're going to get to go to Disneyland every day for the next 8 years.
Not quite, no.
Yeah.
but I will say it is something that I really believe will be a joyful experience. Not saying at all that there will not be challenges, that mm-hmm. that I won't be stretched, and that there will be even perhaps painful and difficult moments. But that can still be a source of great joy when I'm remembering why I'm ultimately doing it. That is, if God is truly calling me, as I believe, to the priesthood, that this is something where I'm doing His will, and it's something I can offer to God. Something that I can offer to people, and I think that just knowing that is a source of great joy.
That's wonderfully put. Yeah, I mean, challenges are they can be challenging, but they're good for you.
Exactly.
They you know, they used to say whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Indeed.
But I admire you, and I admire your fellow seminarians that you're giving it your all for God. You're giving it all to help others find Jesus, to find salvation. There is no higher calling on earth.
I would just also say that what we're essentially doing is the same thing that all Christians, that all people are called to do. That, you know, we all have, of course, our different vocations, our different states in life, but we're all ultimately called to do God's will and look to that as a source of great joy. I know that just looking at, and my parents, for instance, I know the married life is not going to be a walk in the park either. Every vocation is something that will entail sacrifice and that entails difficult days, but the opportunity to serve God and serve the people around us, whether it be priesthood or single life or marriage or religious life, it's a gift that God's given us, and I think that the call to holiness is that first vocation that we all have.
Well, our prayers certainly go with you. And how soon do you leave for St. Pat's?
I believe it'll be the beginning of August.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have an exact date, but that's around the time where most of the summer assignments for seminarians are ending, when the retreats at the beginning of the year start to come up. So it should be right around the beginning of August, first few days in August.
And until then, what is your assignment?
I actually do not have a summer assignment, this being my first year. So mm-hmm. this summer, I've mostly been trying to help out more around the home, around with my family, being involved at St. Rose of Lima, my church, and really just appreciate that this will be the last significant opportunity I'll have to spend extended periods of time with them. So the next month is pretty low key for me, but just trying to spend it well and of course to continue to grow in my spiritual life.
Yeah, enjoy your family. We just had three of our daughters come home from college, and I'll tell you, it's a great come home for the summer. It's a great joy.
Yes, indeed. Congratulations.
Yeah, I remember saying to my wife, "Hey, it's all normal again." It's like, it's what you want for your kids. You want them to grow up and spread their wings and find their way and find God. When they come home, it's joyful too.
Indeed.
Well, all our prayers are with you, Matt, and I sure appreciate what you do, and we will look forward to talking to you again soon, I hope.
Yes, thank you very much, Bob.
Thank you, Matt. God bless. Take care. That's Matt Grimm, who is a seminarian for the Diocese of Sacramento, a new seminarian, and will be at St. Patrick's for his first year starting in August. We'll take a quick break back and say some prayers for Matt and for his fellow seminarians. They deserve it, and they need it, as we all do. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more on the Bishop's Hour right after this. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Drop by and shop at their thrift store, a beautiful, beautiful thrift store at 2275 Watt Avenue. Open Mondays through Saturdays from 10 to 8 and Sundays from 11 to 6. They also accept donations at the store, donations of furniture, appliances, clothing, books, everyday household items. Your donations help to fund the many projects of the St. Vincent de Paul Society throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Do such wonderful, wonderful work, and the thrift store is one of the ways they raise the funds to help people throughout the diocese, and also many of their clients are able to access the thrift store for items that they need. You can give them a call. They will come pick it up as well, but you can give them a call. They're at 916-972-1212. And remember, again, the thrift store is open 7 days a week at 2275 Watt Avenue right here in Sacramento. Well, Bishop Soto refers to Christ the King Retreat Center as the jewel of the diocese, and indeed it is. What a beautiful oasis it is. It's located in Citrus Heights, right in the hustle and bustle of the city, and you feel like you're getting away from it all when you turn off the main road and just come into Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center. Christ the King has served Northern California and the Diocese of Sacramento for over 60 years through parish weekend retreats, individual spiritual direction, and a variety of other programs. For information on all the programs that they offer, including residential programs, give them a call. They're at 916-725-4720, or you can visit them at 6520 Van Maren Lane in Citrus Heights. And we certainly thank the St. Vincent de Paul Society and Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center for their fine and longstanding support of the Bishop's Hour.
Hi, this is Brian Visitation, Director of Media and Communications for the Diocese of Sacramento. You're listening to the Bishop's Hour with Bob Dunning.
Thank you, Brian, and thanks for all you do here at the diocese. That's a big job, and you do it well, so appreciate the fine introduction. Well, we are pleased to be joined by Jenny Teeters, who there's a story about her in the upcoming Catholic Herald. We get advanced copies, and it is a powerful story. It's a compelling story. The title is The Path to Sobriety. Jenny turned her life and will over to God and recovery. Jenny, good day to you.
Good day to you, too.
Thank you so much for joining us, Jenny. I admire your courage in agreeing to do a public story about your struggle and your victory, and tell us what brought about just you agreeing to tell your story to the Catholic Herald.
I'm pretty open about my recovery. It is a powerful story. And because I did not seek help for so long, I was very ashamed and didn't want to confront my family and be honest about it, that it was such relief when that took place. I really have the desire, God has put the desire in my heart to share, to inspire those other, other people to get help sooner than later, or at least understand that there is some hope and healing out there, because I'm, of course, not the only one, and there are many different unhealthy attachments or addictions, many different things. We all deal with different compulsions, and God helps with all of these. So that is why I said yes. I say yes when I'm asked, and I try to be as open as possible.
Well, your story is going to inspire a lot of people. It's probably going to reach some people that really need help, and maybe convince them to turn that corner and reach out. Describe what happened with you. Describe when you early in the story, you describe yourself at the time. I knew inside I was a high-functioning alcoholic. What does that mean?
That means I was able for most of my disease to hold down a job. My husband was a stay-at-home dad for most of our daughter's lives, so I was the breadwinner. I used to teach fitness classes in Sacramento, many different gyms. I got a degree. I got an executive MBA from Sac State, so I had all of these achievements, a long list of achievements and accomplishments, and all of these I was able to do, while very active in my addiction. So when I say high functioning, I hadn't really lost anything yet. I was still able to complete and do a lot of things until I wasn't. Until I wasn't.
So. Is this something that started in your teenage years or early adulthood, or how did this progress?
Yeah, it did not start in my childhood. My parents did not drink. Mm-hmm. It started after I was in my 20s. Whatever the switch that some people have when they have a couple of drinks and feel like, oh, I think I've had enough. This feels good. I don't have that off switch. Mm-hmm. So early on when I was young, and I loved to dance, and I would go dancing with friends, or I would go to a party, or after I got married, we would have a party. Then I would just drink until it was closing time or until I ran out of money. and I didn't really, and I did. I started to see consequences, like not remembering and waking up in the morning. Like, with people telling me how I had behaved or things I'd said I didn't remember. So I understand now that that's not normal to have a few drinks and drink until you black out from the beginning. So it was progressive. So it started off just when I was out having fun. But then, that turned into drinking, a few drinks every night, and then the weekends, and then in the day. And it progressed to where towards the end I was drinking. If I was awake, I was drinking.
So at what point did you realize that it wasn't, I guess, ordinary social drinking and was a problem?
Yeah, in my early 30s, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, after my children and after having children, and yeah, it was fine. Folding laundry was more fun. Drinking, and I found I couldn't not have a drink in the day. When I tried to count the number of days since I hadn't had a drink, and I couldn't remember that. And I remember going to the AA Alcoholics Anonymous website, and they have this quiz. And I asked a series of questions, and I got 100% on the test. So I knew I had some evidence from that, of course, but that's what I was really, really concerned.
That was not 100% you cherished.
No, that was terrifying. It was really terrifying.
Did you react against it and say, oh, that can't be? Or did you go, wow, that is me?
I knew it was me, but I was in denial, definitely in denial that I couldn't fix it. So I tried a lot of things, like I tried to stop drinking hard alcohol and tried only to drink beer and wine, or only my husband, you know, was on this journey with me, definitely is not an alcoholic, but, we would. It was a problem in our marriage, of course, because of my behavior, that he would, we would say as a family, we will only drink if we are out of dinner. Then we found ourselves eating out a lot more, or just on the weekends. And I was always trying to get him to drink more because he would never, in my mind, drink enough so that I could relax. But, it was a problem for sure.
So how did it affect your daughters? Were they aware of it?
They were not too aware of it. They were aware of tension around the house. At one point I promised my husband I would never drink hard alcohol again. So that was at the point I started to hide it around the house and drink it in Crystal Light and other things. But my daughters, no, they didn't really know. The day I told my husband, he said, let's go tell our daughters. So that was 2.5 years ago. They were 15 and 17 at the time. And I understand now that the three of them were huddled together. Did you know? They really didn't know. But some behaviors started to make more sense. I had terrible insomnia. So trying to get me out of bed in the morning, I would always sleep in the day. Because I'd lost my job. That high functioning only functioned for so long. I'd lost my job and was out of work for many months. And so I'd sleep a lot in the day because I couldn't sleep at night. And so they understood that I didn't want to go to any functions. I didn't want to go to any gatherings. I really isolated myself. So that was different. I remember after I got sober, I went to a open house, and my daughter's like, you haven't been to an open house in like 7 years, why do you want to go now? So they started to piece together these things afterwards.
So you're on the parish council at OLA, or Lady of the Assumption. How did you get involved in recovery through the church and through God?
I was away from the church actually for a while, and my dad got sick, and I started to go back to church with him, and it really, really was the only place I felt any joy or peace or safety, and I just felt this calling as I'm staring, in church and participating, that I should be helping, I should be up there, and I have a lot of public speaking experience, so I thought, I'll ask what it takes to be a lector, and then I became a lector and Eucharistic minister, and I really found a lot of joy doing that, and then I read in the bulletin, there was the opening on the pastoral council, so I did that, so I believe that God was really putting this desire in me to participate more in the Mass, bringing me closer into the community. And then shortly thereafter, on the pastoral council, then a speaker came who is the founder of Catholic in Recovery, mm-hmm. and he came and spoke. And I remember going to dinner with he and the pastoral council president afterwards, and they were talking about starting the ministry at Our Lady of the Assumption. And he looked at me, and I said, I'm willing to lead it. I can facilitate, but I don't know anything about the 12 steps. Mm-hmm. And he had these piercing blue eyes, and he stared, was looking at me, and he said, "You're going to." But that is how I was introduced to recovery, because I was in completely against confronting, like I said, walking into an AA meeting or any other kind of fellowship that there was out there. I was really terrified of the unknown. But I was very willing to help in the church, and I began to get exposure to the 12 steps and to this ministry and around other people who were sober. So I actually facilitated meetings for some time, not sober, until I finally surrendered.
So did you? Did other people in the program know that you were an alcoholic?
Yes, they knew that I was struggling with alcohol.
Mm-hmm. And so what's different about, if anything, about Catholics in recovery, say, versus AA and et cetera?
The main thing is, in Catholic in recovery, we can talk about being Catholic. Mm-hmm. The focus of every meeting, there is a reflection that's written every single week, and it's focused on the upcoming scripture. So, for example, last Thursday when we had our Catholic in Recovery meeting, it was focused on the 13th Sunday in Ordinary Time. And so it's this beautiful reflection that each person in the meeting, so it takes turns reading out loud, and say the Lord's Prayer and the Serenity Prayer, so it blends together a lot of format of a 12-step program meeting, but it's always focused on our faith and our scriptures, and we close with the prayer of St. Francis, so everything is really focused, but we can talk about Mary, we can talk about saints, and we can talk about the Eucharist, and talk about reconciliation, all of our sacraments. And another thing I really love about it is the meeting is general. So it's really beautiful to have somebody who's listening to somebody who is struggling with a son or daughter who is not in recovery, and they're there for themselves because they are helpless over this family member who's hurting. And then to hear from someone like myself who is in recovery, and it gives them hope, and vice versa. I understand when I hear their pain, the pain I caused my family, and it just reinvigorates my commitment to my own sobriety and recovery when I'm exposed to that. So there are people who are in our meetings from dealing with anger or lust or control or codependency, and also addiction. So it's very much focused on scripture, and also focused on being Catholic, and focused on just being general, so that we're hearing, that we all deal with things, food disorders. It's very, very open, but not everyone has to say what it is that they're struggling with. So we usually start off with, I might say, "I'm Jenny, I'm a Catholic in recovery," and I'll say the tagline for me is, "I'm an alcoholic, but I also have other unhealthy attachments I deal with," and others may just stop with Catholic in recovery, and they don't want to talk about what specifically they're dealing with, and that's okay.
So in recovery, is there a time when you consider yourself recovered, or is it always a process?
Different people take a stance on that. So I take the stance that I am in recovery, and I have so many days. I was just counting. I actually had of this phone call 23,000 hours of sobriety, continuous sobriety. And other people will say that they have recovered. So it's a really personal decision on how you want to define it for yourself. Yeah.
Does it get easier?
Yes. It does. It gets easier. It's a process for sure. But the most important thing is to come to believe that God is going to help us, and He will help us do what we can't do ourselves. Like, we don't have the power to stop what our body and our brain are addicted to oftentimes, or what we're powerless over when it comes to trying to control another person, or, for example, a family member who's dealing with something that we want to fix them and we want to help them. We can't control other people's thoughts and actions. So we come to believe that our Lord can do that. He can do what we cannot do ourselves. Then it's a relief. It's a great relief. And then life starts to change. So relationship starts to change, and we become healthier, and we start to get things back, like jobs and friends and our health and many things that come with back problems. I've heard this in other fellowships. Yes, I have good back problems. I'm getting all these things back that I may have lost. in my mind, that's a strong healed marriage.
Sure.
And I'm very open in our family about recovery. So my husband could recite parts of various recovery literature. He loves that I go to recovery meetings, and when I say I need to do something, they just came to the door, they knew this call is happening. I shush to them, and they're now all quiet, extremely quiet and supportive, to make sure that I have everything I need to stay sober for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's beautifully put. You know, it's. I think that's. This is really, maybe you don't see it as brave, but I think for a lot of people, it is brave. You know, and they admire that you are trying to reach out and help people. What would you say to somebody who is where you were and is hesitant, you know, to come forward, is hesitant to admit to it, is hesitant to get help? What would you say to them?
I would say that I understand that it's really scary, and that when it comes to substances, it only gets worse. It's 100% guaranteed to be worse the longer it goes on.
Mm-hmm.
So that I can say, and to be in a place where to give it a try, and to be in a place where everybody who's around you wants nothing more than just you again.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll give you an example. There's here's just a beautiful example, and I'll definitely try to keep anonymity. There's one member who came. This person is in their 80s and has dealt with alcohol for some time without addressing it, and broke ribs, broke bones. And so came to a meeting and didn't talk, another one, didn't talk, another one, but kept coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And listened and came back. And then about 6 months has gone by, 6 months of sobriety, and somebody brand new came into the meeting. And this person's talking as though she's talking like, come on, you can do it. Just keep coming back. You know, this is going to work. We're all here for you. You can trust us. So mm-hmm. It's just amazing to see somebody who is terrified and not talking. And then, now they're the cheerleader for the newest person. It's just beautiful.
Oh, that's great. Well, it's a compelling story. I urge everybody to read it when they get a hold of their Catholic Herald. It's written by editor Julie Sly. Jenny, it's a honor to talk to you, and thanks so much for joining us, and God's blessings to you and your family and everybody over there at OLA.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Thanks, Jenny. God bless. That's Jenny Teeters, who is the subject of a wonderful piece in the Catholic Herald, and it's very inspiring that to read it and to read her story. And she's 2.5 years sober now. And she said she was counting the hours. I think she said 23,000 hours. So but Catholics in Recovery, she says it's helpful because they have shared values. They have shared things that they can talk about. They have shared prayers, the prayer of St. Francis, praying to Joseph, praying to Mary, praying to Jesus. Those are things they can all share. That's going to do it for us for today. Thanks for listening. God bless everyone. We'll talk to you again soon. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the Mercy Foundation, enriching lives in the Sacramento region through Sisters of Mercy ministries in healthcare, education, housing, and the care for the poor and elderly. For the Mercy Foundation, philanthropy is one of the most powerful expressions of compassion and love. Just as many people in our community need a hand, countless others are reaching out to them with comfort and hope. You can express your care and concern for the less fortunate with a gift to the Mercy Foundation. You can give them a call, 916-851-2700. That's 916-851-2700. And you can be confident that fully 100% of your contribution will support the Sisters of Ministry of Mercy Ministry or ministries that you choose. And what a wonderful treasure Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts has been for all of us here in the diocese as they transition into new ownership and management. They continue to offer wonderful workshops, wonderful resources for the Catholic community throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Not only does Easter's provide a wide array of Catholic books, both current releases and longtime classics, but they also sponsor a number of valuable workshops and lectures throughout the year. They're located at 6916 Sunrise Boulevard in Citrus Heights. Give them a call, 916-338-7272. We also receive a generous underwriting support by Crumley & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services. If you have questions about retirement, Crumley & Associates can help you with their confident retirement approach that can help define a clear roadmap to get you where you want to go. You can contact them, get all the details at Crumley & Associates, 7956 California Avenue in Fair Oaks. They're at 916-638-4600. That's 916-638-4600. And we are certainly appreciative of the fine and longstanding support of the Mercy Foundation, of Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts, and of Crumley and Associates. We'd like to thank all the wonderful people and organizations, businesses in town and throughout the Diocese of Sacramento who have provided underwriting for the Bishop's Hour, some in the last few years, some have been with us for a very long time. If you would like to be an underwriter for the Bishop's Radio Hour, it's a wonderful opportunity to support this mission and also to support the diocese and also to get some recognition for your organization or for your business. The easiest way to do this is to give us a shout, send us an email, radio@scd.org, and we can give you all the details about helping to underwrite the Bishop's Radio Hour. Again, that's radio@scd.org.
I was sure by now, God, you would have reached down and wiped our tears away, stepped in and saved the day. But once again I say amen, and it's still raining, but as the thunder